Okay, I'm Lynn Davis, and we're running a bit late, and this is a very brief session, so I'm going to jump right into it. I think since Friday afternoon, actually, we've been talking about the present and particularly the future. We're just going to take a little dive for the next 45 minutes into the past. It's been said many times that without a knowledge of the past, we're condemned to relive it. I don't know whether that's true, but it's interesting anyway. So we're going to just hear a little bit about the past with regard to education, employment, and orientation and mobility from our three panellists this morning. And I think what we'll do is let each of our speakers have their brief moment in the sun, and then whatever time we've got left, we'll do a little bit of to the floor. So if I could introduce our first speaker this morning, Margaret Clarkson is from Queensland. Margaret has a background in broadcasting. She's also a trained historian. She has other strings to her bow as well, but in the process of doing some research quite some time ago now, she came across a very interesting young blind man in the latter part of the 19th century who travelled around Queensland teaching blind people. And I think Margaret has some really interesting stuff to say about very early education of blind people, mostly in Australia. There's a lot more that she could say, but we're very restricted. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Margaret just to give us a little bit of a brief introduction to this really interesting early history. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'm thrilled that I'm even able to speak at all because, not just because you've accepted me, but because literally I lost my speech as a consequence of two strokes, one in 2006 and the other in 2010, and I've worked frightfully hard to regain any speech and swallowing at all. And that's got nothing to do with what I'm about to say in terms of education, training and employment of the blind, because we all know, and there are people here who are really, really skilled Braillists, will know that the work of Louis Braille has transformed the lives of blind people the world over and made literacy and education possible. In fact, without it, we wouldn't have this brilliant conference and all these wonderful people here. I next jump to the 1870s and two significant events, one of which was legislative in the British House of Commons, when education, as we know until then, was really the province of churches and dame schools, and it wasn't universal and compulsory. But in the 1870s, the British Parliament passed the Education Act, making primary schooling free, compulsory, and secular to all. That's the key note. All. There's no exclusion to all. So the legislation went through in England, went through in the Dominion of New Zealand, where I did this research. It also went through in the colony of Queensland, where I also done research. Now, the problem was that wasn't followed up by action. Sir Charles Lilly, the Queensland Chief Justice, asked that the government, this is Griffith's government, we named a university after him, God knows why, to establish and train teachers to go to these country schools and city schools and teach blind children and deaf children that term was used, and in New Zealand, Dr. Donald Stewart, who had come from Scotland where he taught mixed classrooms of sighted and blind at Windsor Castle School, he was one of the founders of the University of Otago, said, we must stop sending blind children across the Tasman. They were being schooled here at the Royal Victorian Institute, which was very well equipped, but there was nothing there in New Zealand. So Dr. Donald Stewart trained sighted teachers in the Otago Education Board to learn Braille and teach Braille. And as far as I've been able to discover, the first teacher of Braille in New Zealand was Mr. Patterson at Whakaari School, just outside Dunedin. So that's the 1880s. And unfortunately, the governments didn't follow up with the policies that Dr. Donald Stewart and the Chief Justice Lilly in Queensland asked for. And so we get the growth of charity schools. But the person who's most influential in changing from the individual blind achievers we know from the earlier centuries, the person most influential is Dr. Thomas Rhodes Armitage. You've probably heard of him. He really was the founder of RNIB. And he was from a very wealthy family, was born sighted, trained at the Sorbonne and in Germany, was a physician in the Crimean War, and like those who survived that filth and horror, he came back ill, and really in the course of 10 years, he just lost his sight. So it's not good for a surgeon to be like that. So he gathered around him five other men who'd all been sighted like himself, all graduated from university, so they're high achievers, but they, whether they'd had smallpox or whatever, but they'd been blinded. And so this committee, which called themselves, the shortened name is the British and Foreign Society for Teaching Braille, declared that only blind people can make decisions for blind people. This is a decision made in the 1870s. I've been hearing it here this weekend, but that's good. You're repeating history. Dr. Thomas Rhodes Armitage, who was shocked when he did a two-year survey in London of blind people living in London in most appalling conditions. And he also discovered that at that time, while Braille was in use in Europe, they weren't offended by the French, and Louis Braille, there was only one book in England in Braille. One book. Mind you, the Bible is many books in one cover. But the different institutions, the sighted heads, were all tinkering and playing around with Braille, and in one institution, he found that the boys in one institution were taught one form of Braille and girls a different form. They can't exchange notes that way. So his committee set up Home Teaching for the Blind by the Blind. And while I'm talking about John William Tighe, that's where he learned in the institute in Sydney in the early 1880s, because he'd been born in County Sligo in Ireland and with his parents had come to Sydney in 1859. And his father was a baker at Queen Beanne. And John, as the eldest of a large family of 10 in probably 15 years, really was a busy young man helping his father, but then became a stockman on a cattle station up on the Queensland border. Now, something that is probably not widely known is that the unhygienic conditions on cattle stations dirt, disease, detritus, triggered sandy blight blindness. And we didn't have a Fred Hollows then. And John William Tye, at 20, was struck by sandy blight blindness and was able to get to the Institute in Sydney, where he learned Braille, he learned Moon, and he learned craft skills, because there's no pensions. You've got to have something to sell, preferably not your body. Well, that tragically was what was happening. So he was intending to set up as a cane worker in Sydney when he heard about Dr. Thomas Rhodes Armitage and home teaching for the blind, by the blind, for the blind. And he said, ah, that's my mission. I'm going to Queensland. I'm going to teach the blind up in Queensland. Because, you know, we're a separate colony from 1859 onwards. And so he and his young wife sailed up to Brisbane, and he was equipped by Dr. Thomas Rhodes Armitage with all the Braille equipment, apparatus, and Moon books, and equipped with... he came up with a violin and also his guide dog, because he'd raised this dog since a puppy, and the dog remained loyal to him, as dogs do, when John William Tye lost his sight. So that's how they arrived in Brisbane in June 1883, and he began his work on the 1st of July. The reason I know all this is, while there are no records in any of the blind organisations up there for me to access, Tye was a brilliant publicist. If computers existed then, he would have used them. Thank you. And that was his work. The government didn't know how many blind people were in the colony of about a third of a million. In the first year, he found 150, made 700 visits, and from then on, he looked after them. And unfortunately, the government established an institution for the blind, deaf and dumb, and a report in the Brisbane Courier said, it is not a school, it's a Dickensian organisation. Tye resigned, sailed to New Zealand, arrived there on the 12th of February 1889, and I had the fortune in my sighted days to read the 16 reports he made. And I'll finish on this note. He came back to Sydney, died in 1909, and is buried in the Waverley Cemetery in Sydney. And I hope the organisation can put a plaque on his grave.
There's obviously a great deal more to that story, and I dare say Margaret will probably be asked a few questions in the lunch break. And hopefully there'll be a little time at the end for some more discussion. But we'll move on to our second panellist, David Blythe. And David is going to talk about some of his early experiences in relation to employment of blind people, which might be a little different from some of the things that we discussed in the previous session. David was a very inquisitive 14-year-old who unfortunately extended his curiosity to explosives and blew himself up and became a blind person. So his career trajectory was probably rather different from what he may have envisaged prior to being 14. But it did lead, in the course of time, to a period as the head of rehabilitation services at the RVIB here in Victoria. And I guess that he has quite a lot that he's able to reflect on in that regard. So, David, we look forward to your 10 minutes in the spotlight.
Thank you, Lynn, I don't think I'll need 10 minutes. I recently concluded a series of podcasts, and in that podcast I talk quite extensively about the problems and the issues that I faced as a blinded person in Australia. Firstly, I was denied education in South Australia because I didn't come from South Australia. I was in Darwin. I was then denied employment in Queensland because I wasn't living in Queensland. But I did get a job there because I was born in Queensland, so we got round that one. After 5 years there, I decided I'd come to Victoria, where I was told that I wasn't welcome here either. You should go back to Queensland because each state should look after their own. Fortunately, I was a bit pig-headed, and so I stayed. It didn't only apply to employment, it also applied to the fact I came down here to play cricket because we had a blind carnival in Queensland, and the Victorian boys talked me into coming down to play for the Braille Cricket Club. Well, when we arrived down here in January to start the second half of the season, I was told I needed a 3 months qualification period. So you sort of might get the idea that I wasn't very welcome. But I must say that the employment in those days, and I'm talking about the period, that last period was 1957, so it wasn't that long ago. The employment then was what we used to call the traditional trades, and these were jobs that were done in the community as well. Cane work was a very profitable business for a number of small companies. It was also done at the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind and the one in Queensland. Mat making, like they used to make those mats that they used on cricket pitches. They were commercial propositions. And we worked on piecework, and we earned pretty good money, comparatively speaking, in those days. Some people were earning well above the national average for unskilled workers. We were still called unskilled, although we were very skilled. So that was the type of employment that was available up until probably the early 1960s. There were a number of blind people that had been employed, and particularly in Victoria, trained in music, and I think Dorothy Hamilton can tell me that there was 11 or 12 bachelors of music, very skilled people in music, and they were employed in those fields. There were physiotherapists who could not be trained in Australia. They had to go to England to be trained, but when they came back, they could work in Australia, and that was an interesting concept. And there were then, of course, the revolution came of open employment, and it was mostly in factories. And you think of companies like Kodak. They employed a number of blind people. Naturally, of course, they were in the dark room. You couldn't employ them anywhere else. General Motors Holden was a major employer of blind people, and a number of significant companies like that. The thing that to note about those sort of companies is that they don't exist anymore. So those jobs disappeared. And so we came to the revolution of switchboard training. It was another one that quite a number of blind people took on, became switchboard telephonists. Those jobs have gone. So it seemed to me that we were always just getting into the trade or a business that was about to disappear. But fortunately, through computers and other devices and that now, education is much more accessible to blind people, higher education, I mean. There weren't very many blind people who went to university back in the 50s. But through the 60s, 70s, 80s and now, it is much more possible. And I believe that employment for blind people in particular is either self-employment, in a something that you do yourself, whether you set yourself up, or it is in higher education, skills from law or other tertiary subjects. One of my experiences was that I did... I was sacked by the RVIB, as a matter of fact. I was actually sacked by the RVIB and Lady Nell seeing Eye Dog School, so you sort of get the idea I'm not wanted around here. But one of the things I did was when I was put off by the RVIB, I was in the sales department and they closed that down. And I applied for a job with a brush company called Bond Brushes. They were a New Zealand company. And I got that job. And when I went to my interview, which was on the Wednesday, I should say that when I was sacked by the RVIB, I appealed and they gave me a 3 month dispensation, which they told me at the end of which I would be out of a job. So I had several months to look for a job. And I applied for this job. And I applied on a Wednesday, and it was in June, and Pat Bonish was here from New Zealand, and they'd just lost a salesman who'd been killed in a motor accident, so there was a job going. And he said, when can you start? And I said, well, Monday's a holiday, why should I start Monday week? And he said, well, Monday's a holiday, why don't you start Tuesday? So the first time in my life I felt as I wanted, and so we got there. So that's what I did, and I was a salesman in that industry. And a little thing I tell everyone, whenever I went to see a new customer, if they told me they always supported the blind babies or the guide dogs or that, I turned around and walked out. I never got a sale from anyone like that. When I walk in, a guy says to me, what do you want? I knew I had a chance. So, that's how I found that with employment, and it happened when I applied for the job at Bond Brushes, there was no consideration of my blindness at all. It was I was there applying for a job which they believed and I believed I could do, and therefore I got the job. And that's how I found it in my sales career as well. I think employment is a real issue for blind people, and I think underemployment is probably a major issue that... So many people are doing jobs that they really don't want to be able to do. And that's the reality. And somehow or other, we have to find a way around it. And I believe, listening to that previous session today, I'm sure some of you who have been looking for a job have got more ideas. So that's all I need to say, Lynn.
Thanks, Dave. And no need for the bell. Very good. Our third speaker is Bronwyn Scott, who is an orientation and mobility specialist. Bronwyn began in Western Australia, but is now based here in Melbourne and I think goes all over the place in the course of her work. But Bronwyn has a specialisation in paediatric orientation and mobility, which doesn't have a really long history, it's more recent. We've asked her to speak about some of the history of orientation and mobility in Australia. So, welcome, Bronwyn.
Thank you. I think everyone can hear me? Yes. Excuse me. Okay, so yes, I'll just talk briefly about some of the history and also some of the changes that have particularly happened, I guess, in the last 5 to 10 years in the field, because it's been some quite significant changes. From a historical point of view, we do know that there's biblical references to people who are blind using a stick or a staff as a means of getting around. And the early, very early techniques of orientation and mobility were known as foot travel. It was fairly basic skills, and they were tended to be self-taught skills or passed on by other teachers who were themselves blind. There wasn't really any formal techniques as we would know them now, mobility aids and things like that. In 1929, the Seeing Eye Dog School was established in the United States, and that was primarily focusing on those skills of working with a dog. So even then, the skills that we would now know as orientation and mobility hadn't really been developed. It was really the impact of the two world wars, particularly World War II, but also World War I. Post-World War I, rehabilitation started to commence in institutions like St Dunstan's in the United Kingdom, But from a mobility perspective, it was more teaching people how to be guided safely, sometimes using a very short white cane, but there was not a focus really on independent mobility techniques at that time. It really was World War II when there was a really unprecedented number of blinded veterans who came back to the United States who were young men. They were still potentially healthy apart from losing, you know, their vision. And the numbers were so large that they actually established a hospital specifically just around ophthalmic treatment and what they called the treatment of blinded war casualties. And it was at that time there was a man called Dr. Richard Hoover who was working at that hospital in the United States. And one of his first observations was that he noticed that people were really struggling to get around and to move around. And he was the man who invented the long cane technique and the long cane as we know it back in 1944. And really the techniques that we still use, the standard long cane techniques, haven't really changed much since 1944, he did a good job of inventing those techniques. The terms orientation and mobility began to use about around the 1940s and 1950s as they started to develop those independent travel techniques. So orientation meaning just where am I, where am I going, how am I going to get there? And mobility is the actual act of moving through space, so whether that's using a mobility aid like a long cane or a guide dog or using other means of getting around, how do you actually move safely from one area to another? In terms of the actual development of the profession of ONM, it started in those rehab hospitals in the US in the 1950s. Back in those days, it was considered more of a trade rather than a profession, and it was very much dominated by the medical model of rehabilitation, understandably. So the focus was actually on people who had vision and lost vision rather than those who were born with congenital vision loss. They were pretty short training courses and they were very male-dominated, which is probably the complete opposite of what we would find in the field now. It tends to be pretty female dominated in terms of who works in the field. Within Australia, Dr. Arnold Cook, who I'm sure everybody knows his name, was the first guide dog user in Australia. He actually trained over in the UK and he established that first guide dog school over in Perth in 1951. Australia being such a large country and Perth, Western Australia's a fairly small population compared to the rest of the country, so it was decided that it would make more sense for the National Guide Dog Schools to be based in the eastern states, as Western Australians like to always talk about the eastern states. So it moved from Perth over to Kew in Victoria, where I'm sure people are familiar. The Guide Dogs Victoria's current site was actually a national guide dog association. It started there in 1962, so that's been there for quite a while. But initially, it only offered guide dog training as well. So it wasn't until 1971 that we had the first ONM instructors based trained in Australia. So it's getting, you know, not that long ago, really, 40 years or so. Thank you. My maths isn't that fast. 46 years ago. I'm guessing that might be a significant year for you. And at that stage, it was very much based on the American model of training, and Australia has tended to follow, although initially we started sort of links with the UK, we've tended to follow the US model in terms of service delivery. And for a long time, the Q site here in Melbourne was the only training option for ONM instructors to train, really until the late 1980s. So myself, for example, I trained in 1987, so I came over from Perth to Melbourne. Since then, we've had a shift where rather than being on-site, we now have some postgraduate university courses which have been offered since the 1990s. They've been quite sporadic, and that's actually causing the profession a number of problems at the moment, which I will touch on very briefly. But we've had courses at La Trobe University here in Melbourne, Rennick College, which is connected with the University of Newcastle, Griffith University in Queensland has run courses, and Vision Australia as well has run a vocational education training course. Prior to that, RVIB offered some training as well. So those courses are all postgraduate courses, so people generally need a degree. Can be fairly broad as to what that degree may be in, but they generally, a degree is required prior to actually moving into that profession. The profession's changed a lot since those early days. As I said, initially it was developed to work with people who had had vision and had lost vision. And there's a lot of different considerations when you're working with congenital vision loss or people with acquired vision loss. So we are now work obviously with a range of ages and a range of people. One area that is very big now in the O&M profession is obviously people with low vision. So there are lots of people now with low vision and different eye conditions where they may need to use a long cane or a mobility aid for some of the time. It might be just for particular lighting conditions or when they're in unfamiliar areas. And then other times they may not need anything at all. So there's a lot of work done around low vision mobility, how to use your vision effectively in different areas and those sorts of things. Children, which, as mentioned, is the area that I sort of specialise in. And I guess the biggest change there has been working with babies and very young children on orientation and mobility now. So we basically go into... if we get the referrals, we go into working with families with children before they're even walking. We would put long canes in the house. We'd start teaching children long cane mobility if that's what they needed as soon as they start to walk. So 12, 13, 14 months of age now, kids are starting to learn how to use very cute little canes. A lot of that work, the model of service delivery is also very different to possibly what people here have expected. So it's a lot about coaching parents and providing parents and primary caregivers with the skills to work with their own child. So it's not so much hands-on from the O&M specialist, it's the O&M person passing those skills on to the parent because they are the person with their child every day. We work a lot, we have a lot more people with additional disabilities as well, and some of that has been because of medical advances. There's a lot more children with particularly cortical vision impairment. That's now the leading cause of vision loss in children in Western countries. So that is quite complex because, yeah, there can be a number of other issues and disabilities combined with the vision loss. Technology, as I'm sure pretty much everyone in the room here would also be aware of, that's made a huge difference to O&M, especially in the last 5-6 years. Smartphones and iPads and GPS and, you know, the amount of apps and technological support now for O&M, which is really changing how people are getting around, which is fantastic. It's hard for us to keep up with it sometimes. One more minute. access issues, so we're dealing with changes to the environment have been pretty significant. We're now dealing with silent motor vehicles that engines turn off by themselves at traffic lights or when they stop. Driverless cars is a whole other new thing. Shared spaces is becoming a really common thing where vehicles, bikes and pedestrians all share exactly the same space on the road. So that's a bit of a challenge. And then, of course, the NDIS has become a bit of a challenge for mobility as well. Because of the way the profession has developed, there's actually a number of issues in terms of being recognised as professionals, which the profession is trying to deal with at the moment. So I shall stop there.
Thank you.
How's that? Right on time.
We have a very small number of minutes left, but we do have some. So if there are some mic runners in the room, if people would like to stand if you can or put your hand up, and we'll take a small number of questions. I think that's all we're going to have time for before lunch. So do we have anyone?
Yes. Yep. Hello, it's Ramona Mandy.
Thanks for the presentations. It was excellent. My question is for Bronwyn. I think I'm right in understanding that the formalised professional service delivery for O&M for people with ABI, acquired brain injury, started early 2000s. And I think Guide Dogs Victoria may have been one of the first, but I'd just be interested to know if you could talk a little bit about that and how that's come about and spread and what the sort of status of that in Australia is now.
Yeah, that did. That actually started a bit earlier. I think on my course, which was 87, was the first year that we did neurological training, so that was working specifically with people with acquired brain injuries. So there's some sort of formalised O&M programs that the guide dog organisations tend to do. That is another area where there's, one of the issues we have with O&M is that there's not a lot of published research in some of the areas about the effectiveness of what we're doing, and that that can be a bit of a challenge sometimes in terms of funding and things. But certainly Guide Dogs Victoria here and most of the guide dog agencies are definitely working with clients with acquired brain injury. It's quite a different type of mobility sometimes because it's often around teaching people how to scan effectively and to move through their environment effectively while still dealing with the other things that can be going on. That was a very brief overview.
I think they have to be. Any more questions?
Frances Gentle, is it on? This is a question for Bronwyn, but it might be a broader question for everyone. In my travels to the US, because I know we follow the USA in mobility, the National Federation for the Blind, a lot of the people who are members are having these incredibly long, rigid, lightweight canes, which totally transforms the way O&M would operate in terms of your walk. And I haven't seen any in Australia, and I'm just wondering, are they coming or are people aware of them?
Yeah, that is actually, it's something that we are starting to do more of in Australia. And actually something I meant to mention, and I didn't, was that another big change is that we now are training O&M specialists who themselves are low vision or blind. And that's where the longer canes actually came from, blind O&M instructors and blind individuals in the US. And we are starting to use them in Australia with children. We're definitely using much longer canes than what we used to. It's all, I mean, it's personal choice, it's preference, and there's lots of factors, but we've got lots of different, more lightweight canes, different materials, different cane tips. All those things have changed a lot as well. So I can see a few long ones coming out next to me here.
I use a long cane. I got the idea from the US. My cane is 57 inches long, and I'm, 69 inches high. So it's about a foot shorter than me. But Fred Schroeder had one that really goes up over his shoulder. And I've seen him in America, they've had him up to their foreheads. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Daniel Kish, actually, I'm sure people are aware of Daniel and his work in echolocation, is a very strong advocate for a much longer cane and metal cane tips and things like that. Mm. So we are starting to use those in Australia as well.
Okay. Do we have another question?
Yep. Actually, Bronwyn answered my question I was going to ask. great job to all the presenters. But I was going to ask her, and she answered it, about the blind O&M instructors, because they are a big thing in the U.S. right now. The NFB has really pushed for those. And I'm just curious how that's going here in Australia with the ones that you
I guess I should. I'll just clarify that. And currently in Australia, we don't have any O&M specialists who are totally blind, but we have two that I'm aware of who have low vision who are working in the field. So one is a guide dog user, a long cane user, and they both started in Victoria. Which is fantastic. It gives a very different perspective, and it's a really great to have people with that lived experience of mobility. It's different when you I have full vision. Sorry, I'm having a... Yeah, so we do have a few, which is really fantastic, so it's great.
I've just been given the wind-up signal by the president. Who am I to disagree? So can I ask you to thank all our panellists?
and thanks to Lynn for chairing a great session. I am a bit disappointed that, Bronwyn, you didn't use my favourite word in the English language, though.
Which one was that?
When Dr. Hoover, nothing to do with the FBI, but Dr. Hoover was the person in the US who worked for the Veterans Administration and invented the first rigid white canes. They were actually called Hoover canes. And the technique of using the cane was given a fancy name because you needed to. And the term for white cane use and the whole area was peripatology. So, Bronwyn, how'd you like to be a peripatologist rather than an O&M instructor?
Going off, that's what I say.
Thanks again to our panel.